you have written here a manifesto, basically, for America as the indispensable economic nation. But we're doing it in a changing world, you point out. And it seems to me that what you're talking about here is us giving up some economic influence so we can get some economic influence.
Actually, I don't think it's about giving up anything. I think that what we've done over the last 70 years is we've worked to build institutions that promote both American values and American interests. And we have to make sure that we maintain that ability going forward in a world where the size of countries and the relative influence that they have in the global economy has evolved. So what I'm saying is we have to make sure that we don't see countries pulling away from a system that very much promotes American interests. We need to make sure they stay in it and that all the changes are changes that we think are in our U.S. interest.
This is the system of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the system that came out of World War II. How do you convince countries to stay in it when, as you point out in the first paragraph of this piece, it took the Congress of the United States 5 years to agree on reforms to the International Monetary Fund?
You know, the interesting thing, Kai, is that I think the world wants us to play this role. I think that
That's a gutsy statement.
Over these last 5 years, I had to explain over and over and over again, the last three and a half as secretary, why it was taking so long. The desire was for the U.S. to ratify the IMF reforms and for the IMF to remain the centrally important institution that it is. I actually think that if you look at the structure of the IMF quota reforms, it tells a really interesting story.
Quota reforms are how much voting power.
That's how much voting,
has.
What your share in the IMF is.
Right.
And you know, 5 years ago, there was an agreement where essentially the U.S. went down a tiny, tiny bit, by a small fraction. And other countries in the world were really juggling around their shares, their position, to reflect the shift mostly from Europe to emerging economies. So here you had winners and losers in the United States that was, compared to the others, staying the same, yet we were having a hard time passing it through Congress. It was profoundly in the U.S. interest to have this take place, for the emerging countries to feel invested in the system where the other developed countries were prepared to go along with it. That's exactly the point of my piece. That's why we have to be engaged, and we have to make sure that we do the things that are smart to keep everyone else engaged.
We have been, the United States has been a winner in the global economy, by and large, since World War II. What are we going to do, though? What are you going to do once the United States is not the biggest economy in the world anymore, once we are not the reserve currency with the dollar? Then what happens?
So look, I don't think that there's anyone on the horizon to take the place of the United States, either in terms of our economic position or in terms of the dollar as the reserve currency. Clearly, there are different forces at work in the economy today than there were in 1944, when half the world, most of the world, was coming out of a war where it had no manufacturing capacity, it had no hard currency, and we were the place with both manufacturing capacity and hard currency. I think now we're in a world where population growth and economic growth is taking place in the countries that we've called the emerging economies, making sure that they take seats at the table, adhere to the rules that we adhere to when you have a seat at the table, and that as we make decisions in the future, we have a very strong voice in what all the rules of the road in the future are. That's the way for the United States to maintain its power.
You talk about a rules-based global economy in this piece quite a bit, and the Obama administration's hope that if we set the way, if we lead the way, others will join in those rules. You talk specifically about China. The president has talked about China. How are you doing so far with getting them to play by the economic rules that you want?
Look, I think that if you look at what China is going through right now, it is the most dramatic economic transformation one can imagine, going from a centrally controlled, a non-market economy to an economy where market forces are increasingly going to be driving the way resources are allocated and participation is open. They're not all the way there. They're on a path. What I take encouragement from is when you talk to their economic leaders, they understand they have to make progress on that path to have the China they want in the future. They don't want a China with ghost cities and excess capacity that has no market. we have to make sure that we don't let them off the hook in terms of making those changes, and that we don't just take it as a commitment, but we take the action seriously. We've seen in the world of currency where for years there has been a huge focus on, was China doing things to gain unfair advantage? They now stand up and they say they oppose competitive devaluation, that they will not, they don't see a need for the depreciation of their currency. That's very different than just a few years ago. Does that mean we take our eye away? No, we're going to watch very carefully. If we don't see actions consistent with those words, we will keep the pressure on them. I think engaging with them has helped move them in the right direction, but it's a long journey.
You are making the case for American engagement internationally at a time when domestically income inequality is up, wages have been stuck for decades, and I wonder how you think that's going to play back here at a time when in this political season, free trade and internationalism are taking a beating on both sides of this election campaign.
The last few decades have seen an awful lot of pressures coming to bear on middle-class families in America, middle-class workers in America. And it's not just trade. It's more broadly globalization.
Right.
It's the modern technologies that are changing the shape of what the workplace looks like and what people do at work. And frankly, it's been economic policies and economic crisis that have taken a toll on a lot of middle-class families. I mean, if you came out of the Great Recession having lost your life savings where it was in the equity in your home, if you graduated from high school and college during the recession and couldn't find a job right away, or if you were 50 years old and you lost your job, those are deep scars. I'm not surprised. Now, we have policy solutions that really do work there, but it's not cutting America off from the world. The growth in the global economy is growth that ought to provide future jobs for American workers, both in services and in manufacturing. That's what we need to make sure is the opportunity that's open.
It ought to provide it, but if this issue of foreign affairs lands on some kitchen table in Ottumwa, Iowa, with some auto worker or some farmer or some machinist who's been out of a job for years and can't find work, how do you make the case that this is what's good for the American economy?
I think that if you look at the economic growth in the last 50 years, we have seen around the world lifting people out of poverty, creating conditions for a more peaceful world, for a world where the United States could have enormous markets to sell into, both goods and services. And the fact that it has been very hard for that auto worker is something that we have to ask, what do we need to do as a matter of domestic policy? First of all, there has to be fair trade. It cannot be that the U.S. auto is competing against an auto that is unfairly subsidized by practices which in a good trade agreement aren't allowed. Secondly, we have to make sure that we have the kinds of policies here at home where we provide people with the skills they need to get the jobs that are available in the economy, and where we build the infrastructure in our own society so that we can have a growing economy in the future. I think the idea of cutting us off from the world would ultimately shrink, not grow, the job opportunities.
I tried this with the president last time I talked to him, and he shot me down. So I'm gonna give you the same opportunity. Why is it so hard for people advocating free trade, fair trade, to say to Americans, you know what? Some jobs are going to disappear, and we just have to get used to that.
The challenge is to make sure that everybody who is able to work and wants to work has the ability to have the skills they need to get the jobs that are out there. And I don't think that's something that we should just be talking about at moments when trade agreements are being negotiated or put through Congress. One of the things I say in the piece is that we have to be thinking about that in the periods between trade agreements. So when the president proposes making community college free for anyone who goes in and does the work, what's that about? It's about getting the skills you need. You have several million jobs in this country that are open and several million people in this country looking for jobs, and they're not matching up in large part because of a skills gap. So these are not abstract questions. We don't make horse and buggies anymore, and you know there's a lot of things that change over time. So things like technology coming in and changing what people do and how they do it isn't new. The fact that production moves from one place to another isn't entirely new. What we cannot tolerate is having a situation where we don't invest in our own country to make sure that people have the skills they need and access to the kinds of jobs that will provide for a middle-class income.
You talk a lot about the Trans-Pacific Partnership in this piece, the TPP. You hold it up as a beacon of America engaging with the world, which is what the premise of this piece is. Congress, though, has said it's not going to take it up until a lame duck, if at all. And I wonder if you're underestimating, both on the Hill and among the American people, the degree to which free trade is a losing proposition.
Look, just a few months ago, we passed trade promotion authority through the Congress.
Fast track.
That's the fast track that allows the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement to come up in an expedited way.
Up or down vote.
Up or down vote. An easy matter to approve or disapprove.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh out loud, but
procedurally,
easy is not what
procedurally,
this is going to be.
Right. It's a hard vote. Yeah. It's always a hard vote. It's nothing new that a trade vote is a hard vote. The fact that less than a year ago we had a majority that was willing to vote for the procedural pathway, that's harder than voting for the agreement itself, because in the agreement itself, what we have is labor protections, what we have is environmental protections, what we have is agreements on how we're going to work together on currency so that we don't have unfair practices. I think we have an awful lot of things in the agreement that make it easier, not harder. Now, obviously, this is a difficult environment generally, politically, and in terms of sentiment. But when you have something that is a good product, I believe you can sell it. And I think TPP meets the test that a majority will be looking for when they decide how to vote. It's up to we'll have to send it to Congress, but ultimately it'll be up to them to decide when to take it up. And we will work on a bipartisan basis. It's always been the case that it's required a bipartisan vote to pass trade agreements. And, you know, typically the arithmetic is there's more Republicans than Democrats. And I think what we've seen over these last, you know, months and last couple of years is a little bit of chipping away of that kind of solid Republican support. So we're going to have to make sure on both sides that we maintain the coalition that passed trade promotion authority when we bring TPP to the floor. I'm optimistic that we're going to be able to do it because it's good for American workers.
I want to turn to a couple of real-life examples of America in the global economy, how things are changing, and what this administration is doing to try to help companies compete. Last week, a federal judge unsealed her ruling in a case involving MetLife, the very big financial services company, in which she basically, I'm condensing here for the purposes of an interview, she took MetLife out from under the strictures of the government's requirement for too big to fail. And she said that the Treasury Department and the government's ruling and decision-making in that process was fatally flawed. It was arbitrary and capricious. And she called on you to fully explain what you're doing, to show your work. Why is it so hard for the government to decide what is too big to fail and what is not?
Well, Kai, on that ruling, obviously we disagree with it and the government is appealing. But let me take a step back and just remind everyone what was at issue, what is at issue in this decision. You go back to the financial crisis in 2007, 2008. Nobody expected the companies that failed to fail. They were not sitting on the edge of disaster, AIG and Lehman. It was a surprise. It came out of the blue for most who were watching. Part of Wall Street reform said that should never happen again. We need a process where you're not looking for how likely is it that a firm would fail. You're looking at, if a firm fails, could it bring the whole economy to its knees? We went through that process in a very careful way and have designated not hundreds, but, you know, roughly less than a dozen firms, very big, very interconnected firms. The decisions are hundreds of pages long with detailed analysis. I think it will withstand review, but I think the question we have to ask is, do we ever again want to face the possibility of a firm's failure putting at risk the whole economy? And that's why it's so important that we get this right.
The answer, obviously, is that we don't want that. The question, though, was, why is it so hard for the government to say this is what systemically important financial institutions mean?
You know, I think
because the judge said you didn't do it.
I think that, well, without getting into all the detail, there are certain aspects of the ruling that I think are just incorrect. And I think, you know, take, for example, the premise, should we have to show that it's likely a firm will fail? No. These are very unlikely events. That's one of the questions that the mm-hmm. judge asked. Did you show that it's likely that the firm would fail? It was not likely that AIG would fail or that Lehman would fail. These are very remote possibilities with highly destructive consequences if it happens. So you're not really looking for the probability. You're looking for what is the consequence. That's what the statute tells you to look for. The question of looking at a cost-benefit analysis, the statute didn't have that requirement in it. That's not the measure that is being looked for. The consequences of a failure are immense, almost infinite in terms of the damage that the financial crisis in 2007-08 caused. One would never be able to predict with any kind of precision the scope of that kind of broad systemic failure. So there's a reason that it wasn't put in the statute. I actually think the work was done correctly. I think the work was done well. And we're going to appeal, and it'll be up to an appeals court to decide.
And eventually it will. But I guess let me circle back to this one more time. If it is so critical that these companies not fail, which we all agree it is, even if the statute doesn't require it, why not go the extra mile before imposing these regulations and expenses on companies?
Look, I think that we are very cautious and very circumspect before. That's why we've designated really very few firms. This is not, it's not that there are hundreds of firms out there that have even been examined closely. You're talking about some of the largest financial institutions in the world. And that's where what we've done is gone through the analysis of what would happen if they failed. And you don't, that's a circumstance where it's really quite a dire circumstance. It's not something that's happening in a good, strong economy with everything moving in the right direction. It's where things are going wrong. That's what happened in 2007-08. And what happens when one thing leads to another, and you then have a loss of control of the reaction. So I'll give you an example, and this
sure.
gets into the weeds a little bit. Is it the direct holdings that the firm has in terms of its connection to, say, derivatives? Or is it what happens when the whole market breaks because you're so big that your failure causes the whole market to break?
Go ahead. Use the word counterparty risk.
Counterparty risk.
Go ahead. There you go.
And, you know, so I've just gone through all the principal elements right. of what the court, I think, made a mistake on, and that's what will be appealed. So I actually think the answer to your question is we did a very careful analysis. It took very long time. It took the better part of 2 years. It was a 300-plus page analysis. I feel that the important question here is, will we or won't we have the ability to keep our sights trained on firms whose failure could cause the kind of damage to the economy that Wall Street reform was set up to make sure never happens again? And we're determined to continue our work in this area and to do it well.
How concerned are you that other companies now are saying, hey, look, MetLife did it. We're going to do it, too. We're going to get out from under this. General Electric, to name just one.
Well, I'll leave. These decisions are obviously going to be made by firms, but I'm actually look at what has been said by the companies that have been designated. And for the most part, what they've said is we're looking at our activities. We're looking at what we can do to reduce our risk. And they're talking about coming back and saying, you know, we've sold the riskiest part of our business. Can we? Is that the basis for changing the decision? That's actually the system working. If you end up with them making voluntary decisions for reasons that are business driven, and you end up with less overall risk. So I'm not sure that this is a broad set of issues, but obviously it's for every firm to decide on their own.
Tax inversions. Last week, you came out with, I believe it's your third
Minister of Action
on tax inversions, companies buying other companies overseas to change their tax liabilities. It, I guess, worked the way you wanted it to because Pfizer and Allergan have called off their merger. Both of the CEOs of those companies, though, came out last week and said, we were playing by the rules that Congress made up, and now here's the Treasury Department coming in and changing them on us midstream. Isn't that sort of the antithesis of what your article is about, that we have to be able to adapt and play in a global economy?
Look, I think anyone who has listened to what I've said over the last two-plus years could not be surprised that we were looking to do anything we could do administratively to stop the pipeline of inversions. We took action twice administratively. It had some effect each time we did it. And each time we made clear that we were looking at taking additional action. And we even said that in the case of earnings stripping, we were looking at what could we do in that regard. I think that the right answer here is legislation. There's no doubt. I've been saying all along the only way to do it really so that it sticks is legislation. I'm sure there are smart tax lawyers and accountants out there looking at for loopholes in the guidance we put out last week. But you ask the American people. The American people are clear that they don't think it's fair that a company would get all the benefits of being an American company, the research and development in America, the rule of law that we cherish in, but also invest in, the skilled workforce, the infrastructure, and then change your address to avoid U.S. taxes. They don't get to do that. This is tax season. American families are sitting down. They're reporting their income. They're paying their taxes. It just doesn't feel right that you have a system that lets companies behave differently.
I get all of that, but don't you think this plays as the U.S. government going after two companies specifically with this administrative action?
We don't make policy based on individual companies.
Sir, come on. You
look at the impact of this company, it sends a powerful signal in the future of what is permitted and what is not permitted. And the goal has been all along to stop the pipeline. We don't do it retrospectively. So if you closed a deal, if you completed a deal, I don't know what other deals are caught up in this. But, I hope that we've stopped the pipeline for a while.
This piece did not come out of the Treasury Department speech writing shop. You wrote it yourself. And as we sit here under a bust, actually, of Alexander Hamilton, and with Hamilton all in the news, I wonder if this is Jack Lew's legacy piece, right?
I have thought that after 3 years of fighting a kind of quiet fight on the IMF quota reforms, dozens if not hundreds of conversations with congressional leaders, that there was a real burden to make a public case so that maybe this will be a little bit easier the next time. It has to be that there is a broader understanding of what we do to create the space for the U.S. to have the influence that we need for our economic and our national security. And I thought this was an appropriate moment to do it. Obviously, before we had completed quota reform, before we got TPA through Congress, before we got the Export-Import Bank reauthorized, it would have been more challenging. But the fact that we could at this moment say we have reasserted the U.S. Global leadership role in the economy, it was an important moment to take stock of it.
A little pride of ownership there. I see a smile on your face.
I'm proud to have been part of it. It's not all my work.
Last thing, then I'll let you go. I need some love on the $10 bill. Hamilton's staying, right?
We're going to have a really exciting announcement really soon. People have to hear the whole of what I've said, so I'm going to just take a second and repeat what I've said, but to hear it all together. We started this conversation. I started this conversation last summer. We've heard from millions of Americans. That means that there are people around the country at school lunch tables, at senior centers, at workplaces, talking about what women should we recognize and how have women contributed to democracy in America. As a student of history, that is just exciting and thrilling that people are actually focused on this. We're doing something bigger than just one face on one bill. And we're going to be looking at the whole series of bills, the $5 bill, the $10 bill, the $20 bill. And we're looking at how to use the front and the back of the bill to tell stories.
Right.
And it is going to be a little bit bigger than people think because they've kind of focused on the one piece of it. But stay tuned. We're going to have an interesting announcement very soon.
Soon?
Yeah, very soon.
All right. Mr. Secretary, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Good to be with you, Kai.